Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's the Writer's Block. It's a Sunday. It's 10 p.m. And you know what that means? It means the Writer's Block. And with me here tonight is Anthony Bavaria, a writer for Countercurrents. Anthony, he's returning guest to the block. How are you doing tonight?
Good. And thank you again for having me on. How are you?
Well, I'm doing fine. As you can see, it's coming in nicely. The goatee's coming in nicely. I got this relatively new sweater, which I'm now showing off. It is sweater weather. We are finally getting some real goddamn November weather over here. It's, I would say, quite enough with the unseasonable warmth. So, yeah, I would say I am doing fine.
Good.
That's good to know, I guess. And we're going to get into it. We haven't had a best month ever type show in a while. I think 2-3 months maybe, but we're now get back in the saddle. We're going to have one of these review shows, which they're always fun to have. They're always diverse, and they're about inviting and, you know, showcasing what has been done on Countercurrents this month, but also inviting interesting people so that I can riff off of them and they can riff off of the audience and thus produce good content. That is the trick to producing good content. Just have interesting and good people on and let them interact with you, with your audience, with each other. And it's never failed me in the past. And Anthony is certainly an interesting character, but we're going to get into it a little further. And of course, let's just get the crass financial concerns out of the way. This show, the Countercurrents operations, it depends on the donations of people like you, my dear viewers. So if you would just donate to our Entropy. So if our admins would just put the Entropy link in the Odyssey and DLive chats, and of course you can also see it on the screen insofar as you're catching it live, and you can post questions through Entropy. Just enter entropystream.live/countercurrents. And it's going to say we're not streaming. That's because we're not streaming on Entropy. Well, not yet. But I will have access to the donations and questions. I will read them all out, all donated during the stream. You can ask me questions. You can ask Anthony questions. We will do our best to answer your questions. I mean, that's why we're here. Of course, we also have Cash App. Now, Cash App, I cannot see if you donate, but they do take a lesser percentage of the donation, 5% as opposed to 15%. So if you just want to give to Countercurrents out of the goodness of your heart, Cash App is the way to go. And of course, our moderators will put in the Cash App link as well. And we also have MoonPay. Now, MoonPay, it's a little different. What happens is you click, you give us money with your fiat currency, with your credit card, but it converts to cryptocurrency and goes into the Countercurrents wallets, right? So we can fund the operation. And those are all of the, you know, just cash ways, but you can also donate through this operation over on DLive and Odyssey. And on DLive, we accept the lemons, right? They're a, sort of a token which stands in for money at DLive. And at the end of the year, we usually cash out the lemons. And some years it's good, some years it's bad. It's, you know, a little leaner. But every little bit helps. And of course, of donations of 100 lemons or a diamond or higher, you can also post questions over on DLive. Now, over on Odyssey, right, there are two ways in which you can donate. The first is through Cash Money. What you do is you type out your comment in the Odyssey comment box, and then the donation button comes online at the bottom. You click the donation button, and you can donate cash money to us, you know, actual currency. However, Odyssey also has its own homegrown cryptocurrency, which is the Library Coin. And we need those to keep the replays of this show and other video and audio content up on Odyssey, because Odyssey is apparently pay to play if you're a content creator. So even if you donate a Library Coin, which I guess you get some of it for free for completing various Odyssey challenges, it also helps Countercurrents maintain our presence on Odyssey. And of course, I think they are also convertible to cash money. Now, I don't know the conversion rate. I haven't really looked into it, but every little bit helps. You know, 1 cent, 2 cents, $2, $5. You know, they snowball into something very interesting at the end of the year. Now, those are all the direct ways to donate to Concurrents. There's also an indirect way. And the indirect way is to purchase the fine products of our sponsor, Alaska Chaga. And I'm sipping Alaska Chaga tea. It's delicious. It's good for you. It's got, I don't know if it has electrolytes, but it does have antioxidants. And it does help me get a good night's sleep, helps with my digestion, helps with my immune system. You know, it's late November. It's finally turning cold. A lot of people are catching cold, but not me, because I'm drinking Alaska Chaga. And of course, because I also dress appropriately for the weather and wait about 2 to 3 hours after washing my hair to head out. That's just sensible precautions you take in cold weather conditions. But I think those are all of the fat, crass financial concerns for tonight. I think we have advertised all of the ways in which you can donate to Countercurrents and support this operation. And with that being said, let's welcome Mr. Anthony Bavaria. He's a returning guest. And Anthony, what have you been up to since the last time you were on the block?
Thank you for having me again. And I guess not too much. Just busy with a lot of normal life stuff, work and family and everything like that. And then always perpetually working on a few writing projects. Since we last spoke, I've just done a couple book and film reviews that have popped up on Countercurrents, and not too much else writing wise. That's about it.
And that is a shame. Of course, not everyone has the maniacal commitment to writing I have. Well, sometimes, you know, I produce literal garbage, but at least one per week.
No, it's good. It's good to keep, keep your pen dipped in ink and continuously writing, because A, that's how you get better, and B, that's how you ultimately produce something good.
Yeah, it's a million monkeys at a million typewriters type of situation, but it is what it is. But yeah, any aspiring writers out there, you got to actually do the thing. It's like a muscle. You have to work it out. If you don't do it for a long time, it atrophies.
Absolutely.
Just like in working out, if you feel that there's 1 week where you just can't do it, your body's telling you can't do this, you can't do it. Your body knows better than you. So it's okay to take a rest. It's okay to take a break. Just don't make it permanent. Don't get into a rut. And it really is like working out. Like, but speaking of well-deserved rest, Anthony, you're an American, right?
That's right.
Special kind of human being, number one America, whatever the floscules are.
Yeah.
And you people recently celebrated Thanksgiving, right?
That's right. Yes, we did.
Yeah, it is a uniquely American holiday, and yes, Canadians in chat, I realize you too have a Thanksgiving, no need to remind us, but it is a uniquely American holiday, and we are going to be discussing C.F. Robinson's article for Countercurrents, Thanksgiving, the Only Holiday Unique to the American Ethne. That's a very interesting text, but before we get into it, Anthony, could you, as an American, just give us some of your thoughts on Thanksgiving. Pretend I've never heard about it and just red pill me on Thanksgiving.
Okay, yeah, sure. So C.F. Robinson does make some, broad brush points about Thanksgiving and its background in his really good article. But just the very basic explanation of it in modern times, at least, is you get together in late November with your immediate and extended family, and we have an American style big dinner that's centered around eating turkey. The history of it depends on who you talk to, but it has remotely religious origins. It has connotations with the founding of the country and some of the earliest settlers, the Pilgrims in New England, and most of that isn't really discussed at dinner with your family. It's pretty much just like I said, an extended family get together, and Americans that love football, which is a lot of Americans, all watch football. There's always a game on that day as well. And that's the extent of it in modern times, pretty much.
That's interesting. So there is really no discussion of the history of the holiday and what it means for Americans, huh?
No, I mean, it never really translates that way. Though Thanksgiving isn't overtly religious, obviously, like Christmas or Easter, those holidays too, you know, your average American family getting together isn't having an overtly religious experience on those holidays either, right? Everyone's just hanging out, BSing and eating together. Maybe you went to church that morning and that's about it. But since Thanksgiving is more secular and less overtly religious than those other holidays mentioned, yeah, there's no one's, at least I've never seen in my extended family or any other get-togethers I've been to, no one's really getting into the roots or origins of it, what it means today or anything like that, which is honestly why I liked C.F. Robinson's article. He kind of got into the background of that a little bit.
Yes, and the background of Thanksgiving is really the history of Plymouth Rock, of the Puritans and their interactions with the Indians and their interactions with the harsh new environment which they found themselves in. It's very interesting. In the comments, I saw a little back and forth between Greg Johnson and I forget which commenter about Canadian Thanksgiving. And what I find very interesting is that C.F. Robinson used the words American ethnic, right? So we hear this a lot, that there is no American ethnicity, that Americans are mutts, Americans are this, Americans are that. And as someone, you know, who is a European who could say all these things, I don't want to say them because they're not true. I see Americans, you know, white Americans, and they are a specific nation, right? I think they satisfy all of the parameters of being considered a specific and separate nation, which maybe is not fully aware of itself right now, but it's increasingly becoming so, and hopefully it will become aware of itself soon enough to effectuate its own survival. And this is why I like spotlighting all of these things that basically are uniquely American, which shine a light on American culture and on American ethnicity as such. Now, Thanksgiving, it's like a mid-November, late November type harvest festival. Everyone jokes around, oh, this is just about eating turkey. But, you know, showcasing abundance was very important for our ancestors and still is, really. We live in such an age of plenty that I don't think we understand the degree to which our ancestors revered abundance at feasts, abundance of food, abundance of wine, you know, drink and heat and the togetherness of family. Last week, Jim Goad asked me a question, do we have anything resembling Thanksgiving in Macedonia? And we do. The feasts of the saints and the very popular ones of this period are St. Dimitri and St. Nicholas, both of which are associated with me. And while we joke, of course, about Americans stuffing themselves on Thanksgiving, we also practice abundance in the preparation for the feasts here. I think that's something that speaks to our soul, because we are children of the winter, right? We white people. When you see Absolutely. An abundance of food, it makes you feel good. Like, yeah, we're going to live through the winter.
Oh, totally. And, you know, similar to Halloween, right? It's at the end of the summer time period, the harvest, and it's the you know, the last major crop that's gathered before the long shitty winter sets in, and this is what you're going to be living off of. So you might as well have a party around it, right? And it's a way to signify a special occasion. And now we get to have year round abundance, but the festival aspect and the history and the origin still stands there.
Yes, it's one of those things, I guess. It's Festivals and feasts. They basically were milestones along the year for our ancestors, whereas we have a very different perception of time from our ancestors, I guess. We are more disconnected from the cycles of time. We're more disconnected from the cycles of nature. Let's not forget that the year revolves around nature, mm-hmm. around the changing of the seasons, and the day revolves around the changing from night and day, from these transitory periods of dawn and dusk. And my personal favorite is the time of the penumbra, right, which is right after dusk, after the sun has set, but when the sun's light is still visible in the sky. I think that's the most beautiful part of day.
Yeah, what do they call it? A twilight hour or something like that? Or magic hour or something?
The Latin term is penumbra, but I don't know the name in English.
Are you familiar with the director Terrence Malick? He's done a lot of like art house films.
Malick, that sounds Arabic.
I think he partially is, yeah. He did an American war film, The Thin Red Line, but in the 70s, I think it was, he did a film with Richard Gere called Days of Heaven, and it literally took him like 2 years to complete filming, something absurd, like a year or two, because he exclusively shot the whole film on that exact hour of time that you just mentioned. The sun has already set, but you still see the daylight, and his theory in making an artistic film was something magical is happening then, and you can only capture it in that moment. So he only was allowed to shoot an hour a day because he filmed the whole movie in that one special time period of each day. And it really is beautiful. The movie's not the best in the world, but it's like looking at a painting. It's really beautiful.
That's something you notice about old films. The directors cared about presenting a good picture to the world. Taking the picture, and something I think has been forgotten in modern filmmaking, people focus on, oh, dialogue, action. Does this film look good? Right? When you look at it, does it calm the mind? Does it give meaning? Does it charm the heart? I don't think people look at that.
I couldn't agree anymore. While I was reading C.F. Robinson's article on Thanksgiving, it got me thinking about American history and the founding of the country. And he kind of does mention in the article that the descendants of the Pilgrims, on which Thanksgiving is predicated on, went on to basically conquer the rest of the continent. And it made me think of the film The Revenant with Leonardo DiCaprio. And that's another film that hits the nail on the head with exactly what you just mentioned. It's just incredibly visibly striking. And there doesn't need to be really any dialogue in that movie. Just to watch it, from a cinematography standpoint, is absolutely breathtaking. But that is directly tied to American history and the founding of the country. They don't necessarily show any scenes of Thanksgiving. I remember when I was a kid learning about Thanksgiving in like elementary school, there was always some like, in my history textbook, there was some like watercolor painting of a pilgrim with gold buckles on his shoes exchanging a turkey leg with an Indian or something like that. And they're all smiling and having a good time. But then you watch a movie like The Revenant, and though it is, still, it's just a movie, it kind of shows probably what the frontier was much more like in that time period and well before. And it just looked like one perpetual miserable camping trip. It's striking and it's amazing to watch and view and think about, but yet it didn't necessarily look fun. And I'm sure Plymouth was the exact same way when the Pilgrims first landed there.
Right. And The Revenant takes place in Montana, I believe. So
yeah. It's significantly later. I think the 1840s or 50s or something like that. So, yeah. The age of the frontiersmen and the fur trappers and all that kind of stuff, which was, it's literally centuries after the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock.
Yeah. Much closer to that period in time, although still almost 200 years later, is The Last of the Mohicans.
Yeah. Right?
Which is another one of these films with amazingly striking visuals, right?
Oh, yeah.
And of course, the music for Last of the Mohicans, probably one of my all-time favorite movie soundtracks. It's just got that thing. And yeah, it's racially problematic as a film, it tries to get you feeling guilty for being white and all those poor Mexicans and those poor Hurons. But I like it that that for once it's historically realistic and portrays an Indian tribe as the villains, you know, the Hurons and what's his name, Magua. And of course, it has that speech by Magua about the reality that white men, we tend to take a lot of shit from white women, and something that the non-whites do not do. But it is uniquely of our race. I know about it, but what am I going to do? Act like a non-white? I don't think so.
Speaking of that thing you mentioned there with the taking shit from white women, that's really funny. I just finished reading a really good book recently called Westering Man. And it also takes place in the same time period as The Revenant. It's about the frontiersmen conquering the North American continent, who none of which really were, descendants of pilgrims and wasps. They were almost exclusively to a man Scots-Irish. That's a whole other thing. But they talk about in the book, the guy that wrote it, Gilbert, did his homework. And there's always this myth of the frontiersmen stealing away the Indian princess or the Indian woman from her tribe, dragging her by the hair against her will. And he talks about in Westering Man how it was actually the exact opposite. Western men had their cultural norms of courtship and treating women a certain way to basically prove to them, you know, they were worth marriage and all that kind of stuff. And the Native American men had no such practice. They pretty much procreated at random. There wasn't really nuclear families in a lot of tribes. So when these big burly Scots-Irish men come over the hills and they see these exotic, beautiful women, they were showering them with gifts and attention and everything like that. And in a lot of tribes in the plains, it became a status symbol for Indian women to have themselves a white man because they were treated good. And it was like a big deal, to get yourself some guy that would give you gifts and take you away from some miserable, teepee tribe or something like that. It's just the exact opposite of what is normally portrayed today. I found that fascinating.
Yeah, we see the results of such basically behavior. We call them Latin America.
Yeah.
I love that meme, how much more proof do you need that race mixing is bad? Is not an entire continent proof enough?
But, oh my God.
It is what
well,
it is. What
honestly, Robinson mentions that in his article a little bit. So I took some notes here on it. Let me just read on my page real quick. So he actually, in his article, he compares differences in Spanish America vice WASP Northern America. So the differences in colonization efforts that took place in North America vice Central and South America. So when the Spanish landed in Central and South America, they were met with pretty early on in their colonization efforts, really substantial success. They conquered the Aztecs and the Incans. They amassed huge fortunes in gold that they stole from these Indian empires. And they quickly turned the native populations into slave labor to continue to mine more gold. So this was a huge deal for the Spanish, whereas, the North American WASP settlements weren't necessarily doing this right off the bat. And they approached their interaction with natives much differently. I think Robinson refers to it as a realpolitik relation with the Indians early on, whereas the Spanish colonies were, via the Catholic Church and the Pope, were encouraged to miscegenate because that was going to make more Catholics, right? It was a very overtly religious venture as opposed, obviously it was in the North too, the separatists leaving it. Europe and all that, but they went about it very differently. And like you said, the results to this day speak for themselves. Compare North America.
If I don't want to be uncharitable to the Spanish here, the situation which they encountered in Mexico and the Andes was far, far different from what the Puritans encountered up in New England.
Oh, massively,
for starters. You know, the chief difference between Mexico and America is that, I mean, United States of America, or at least the Eastern Seaboard, is that Mexico was, in pre-Columbian times, very densely populated. There were a lot more Indians in Mexico than there were in North America, right? In Massachusetts and all these places.
I think that was particularly true for the eastern coast of Mexico, like on the Caribbean side. Yeah, it was very
where eastern the Aztecs coast, yes, were. But where the Mayas were, but also in central Mexico, where you find today Ciudad de Mexico, you know, District Federal, where it's actually probably one of the most, it was the largest city in the Americas. Tenochtitlan was over there, probably in the world at that time. The superpower of the Aztecs was because they had so much food from cultivating on the lake, on Lake Tenochtitlan itself. They had a massive population.
I'm amazed you could pronounce any of these places. This is blowing me away.
It's actually fairly easy, right? The pronunciation rules of the Nahuatl language are very simple. And I have a superpower. I can read Cyrillics, and my native language is phonetic, right?
So there's is Cyrillics all those little asterisks on top of the letters? Is that what that is, right?
No, it's the Cyrillic alphabet, right, which is used in Eastern Europe for the Slavic languages mostly.
Yeah, you got all those little squiggly lines and stuff above letters, right?
No, not necessarily.
Oh,
it's a whole nother alphabet. My point being, right, my native language, Macedonian, is phonetic, which means there's a letter for every sound. So basically, if I have trouble pronouncing something, I listen to a native speaker pronounce it, write it down phonetically in Cyrillics, and then work from that to speak it in English. So, you know, you look at the word Tenochtitlan spelled out in English, it looks intimidating. But if
it does.
You realize that, yeah, this is just a very simple string of sounds, not challenging at all, right?
I'm still working on English. Tlaxcala. I'll defer to you.
Right. So, yeah, the superpower of the Aztecs was that there were so many of them, and they were warlike, of course, so they would just swarm all of their enemies and just conquer everything in sight. That was really the difference between them and the Indians of the north. There were not many of them outside of maybe the Pueblos and Navajo, who were not even not even properly civilized. Let's not kid around. The Aztec Empire was a serious civilization.
Yeah, North American was just highly nomadic.
And so was Brazil, right? So
yeah.
The three major civilizations of pre-Columbian America were the Aztecs, the Incas, and the Mayans. So you have the Aztecs and Mayans in Mexico, and they have the Incas in what is today Peru, Chile, Bolivia, all of these places. And of course, the way Spanish treated them, and I think that Spanish America has three general approaches to how it handled its Indian problem. The first is what Uruguay, Argentina, and Chile practiced, was invite white people to immigrate. And it worked fairly well, you could say, although at the cost of diluting the Spanish culture. So you look at Argentina, you know, among Spanish speakers, they mock them for having an Italian-sounding accent.
Because
most Argentines are Italian-descended. Then you have basically the what I like to call the Bolivarian model, which is with a model of the post-Bolivarian states like Colombia and Venezuela, which is white supremacy, essentially. Mm-hmm. You have a white and castizo overclass ruling over teeming brown hordes. And you have the Mexican model, which is a mixture of the two. So you invite white people to emigrate, but you demand they assimilate into Spanishness, and you also try to wrangle and partially assimilate the brown hordes, and you model yourself as sort of a halfway house between the United States and France in political structure.
Yeah. And then in North America, we just killed most of them, right?
Yeah, which is... looks like the simpler solution until you realize that there were so fewer Indians, much fewer Indians in North America.
Yeah.
And just killing them was a feasible option. Whereas for South America, outside of Brazil, it was really not an option.
No, absolutely not. I had a friend not that long ago. He was kind of making it up as he went, but it did seem to hold some merit. He mentioned how a lot of former colonies, European colonies, the host countries of which were Catholic, their former colonies are often always in shambles. So if you look at former Italian colonies or French colonies or Spanish colonies, as opposed to, the Protestant nations, primarily England, and their former colonial possessions that are on the whole doing a lot more better. And it actually transcends race, right? Like, obviously, the United States is doing good. It's primarily white nation. But, you know, you could make the argument that India, which is obviously a non-white nation, is in certain ways doing a lot better than, you know, name your former Italian, Spanish, or French colony. And I kind of thought that had some weight to it.
If I'm being completely honest, I would rather live in Argentina than India.
I agree with you as well.
I would actually prefer to live in District Federal, you know, Ciudad de Mexico, to India, because, you know, from what I understand, I've never been to Mexico City, but it's significantly wider than the rest of Mexico and India.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely
cleaner too.
I brought it up though, because I remember in Robinson's article, he mentions the Protestant work ethic, Weber's ideas on that and everything. He doesn't talk about Weber. He just mentions the Protestant work ethic. But as far as, you know, building a new civilization goes, or a whole new colony, there does seem to have been a remarkable difference in the way the Protestants handled it as opposed to primarily Catholic countries and how they handled it. I mean, look at, you know, what is now French, or what was French Indochina, or any of the Italian possessions in North Africa or other French ones in South America. Like, they're total shitholes.
But yeah, I would rather live in Vietnam than India, which was French.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it comes down primarily to race. You look at Vietnam and Cambodia and you compare them to Haiti. Now, both were French colonial possessions.
Mm-hmm.
But Vietnam, you know, I don't think I'm going to be dismembered and eaten alive if I go out walking the streets of Hanoi or Phnom Penh. Because, you know, we have people in this movement who live in Cambodia, right? They say this is a nice place to live, and it's not Europe, but it's a nice place to live, right? And you think about it. Okay, so Protestant possessions is Sierra Leone, which is an old English possession. Is it a better place to live than, let's say, let me think of a good place. Yeah, Uruguay, old Spanish possession. Is South Africa a better place to be than, I don't know, name a French possession which is not black?
Yeah. Well, to your point with South Africa, it all depends which neighborhood you're in, right? You know, the racial makeup of the neighborhood
it's not whether you're English or French, or whether you're Catholic or Protestant. The question is, what's the race of the people there, right? And let's compare like to like. Let's compare English possession to English possession. I would not want to be in Sierra Leone or India, but I wouldn't mind being in Australia or Canada, right? Yeah. Or Hong Kong, right? Let's face it, you know, Asians are civilized people. They aren't want to murder you on the street,
yeah,
right? Or French to French, Haiti to Cambodia, or Spanish to Spanish, Guatemala to Argentina, or Portuguese to Portuguese, Mozambique to the southern states of Brazil.
Yeah, you'll take any former English colony in Asia, whether it's India or somewhere in China, as opposed to any former English colony in Africa. And yeah, I mean, that's true on the whole. It's just, I feel like every former Catholic colony, and keep in mind I'm Catholic, but it's still a total shithole. They just in the age of decolonization, it seems as if the British made somewhat of an effort to at least attempt to get the place up and running on their own before they peaced out. Whereas, you know, French and Italians and, you know, the Belgians in Congo, like overnight, they were like, all right, we're out here.
Italians, how many colonies did Italy have? Libya and Abyssinia?
What's the other one there? Over by Somalia. It's
not a representative sample.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, they were incredibly short-lived, I guess, but still had no problem piecing out overnight.
I'm thinking about it. You know, how did the Germans fare in colonialism? How's Angola doing? How's Tanganyika doing? Right, one of these.
Yeah, and they're a handful of tiny islands they had dotted throughout the Pacific that I think Japan took over after the First World War, essentially.
Yeah. The Japanese don't like to talk about that one at the Axis reunions, right? How in the first one they were on the wrong side. So were the Italians. Come to
yeah, absolutely.
Right. Oh, it's those damn historical happenings. But yeah, this is what happens when you start discussing Thanksgiving. You inevitably comes to colonialism and. Oh, the colonial guilt. Now they're calling it Day of Mourning, these American Indians.
Yeah. Well, that's how Robinson, he ends the article. He talks about essentially at this point for people on our side of the fence, celebrating Thanksgiving is essentially like a political act of defiance at this point. Because like you just said, it too, like everything else, is racist now, right? So he says like, you know, almost in an act of defiance, celebrate it regardless, which is... I like the way he ended it like that.
Yes, a turkey leg might as well be a loaded gun.
Yeah, days. I guess so.
I think that Columbus Day still has an edge over Thanksgiving, right? Because Columbus really was, because the Puritans practiced realpolitik, they did not have Columbus's immediate, how do I put this? Exploitative attitude. I mean, yeah. Columbus saw the New World and saw a big bundle of money and titles, which he secured for himself.
Yep.
The Pilgrims, they were fleeing, of course, religious persecution, or so we're told, but the Pilgrims were really the kind of people whom reasonable society would prosecute and should prosecute in any case. So it's a more of a mixed bag over there, but it is, I guess, an implicitly white thing to celebrate Thanksgiving.
Absolutely,
it is in keeping with the Indo-European calendar. It does fall on one of the how many? I think it has 8 points, which represent the turning of the wheel of the year.
Oh yeah.
And just the foods themselves, right? What was it? So it's turkey and it's cranberry sauce, but what else is?
Turkey, cranberry sauce, stuffing, mashed potatoes, gravy, corn, which is obviously an incredibly North American thing, corn on the cob or creamed corn, rolls, just essentially crappy bread. Those are the main the main course options, and then for dessert, it's always like apple pie, a lot of pies and stuff like that. Hyper American stuff. And I think actually Benjamin Franklin tried to make the turkey the country's bird instead of the eagle. And his argument was something along the lines of like the bald eagle is found elsewhere in the world, but the turkey is like specific exclusively to like North America. So I think his colleagues were all like, nah, dude, that's too ugly.
Yeah. I mean, it is, I guess, considered a sort of national symbol, the turkey for America, but it's a very interesting bird. We have them here in Europe now. These are all colonial foods. We'd never have access to them if not for the discovery of America.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I get horrible acid reflux every time I eat corn. Right, so I'm very European in that.
Your body wasn't made for it, yeah.
Which is another thing I'm thinking, right? Because my favorite vegetable is probably by far the tomato, right? Which is also from America and from the deadly nightshade family. So yeah, chew on that for a little while. I love turkey. I just prefer the turkey to the chicken. Chicken is just too bland for me. Although, you know, it depends on how you season it. But turkey, you can just put it in a saucepan and put garlic and lard in it, and it's good to go.
Whereas yeah, chicken, it's delicious.
It's beautiful. I love fowl. I love bird meat. I love turkey. I love duck. I love goose. It's one of those things, I guess. And what are other American foods? Yeah, potato, right? Which have somehow become a symbol of Ireland. That's a different sugar from the cereals, right? You can actually eat that on a European metabolism and not become horribly obese.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it's funny, like you said, you mentioned colonial foods, like, with the Irish in America, St. Patrick's Day, everyone makes corned beef and cabbage. But if you go to Ireland on St. Patrick's Day, no one's eating corned beef and cabbage. It's an Irish American thing, right? It's not an Irish thing. And it's funny how some of those particulars make it back across to Europe, and some do or don't get absorbed back into the culture.
Yeah. I mean, Mrs. Julie, she's fond of avocados, and I don't like them. It's not that I don't like them. The texture is always weird, but an American friend said to me that you cannot get good avocados in Europe because they have to ship them frozen. So they lose all their taste. And he has someone who has eaten avocados in both Europe and America. So I don't know. I guess he's right. I've never had avocados in America. I mean, here in Europe, they have no taste and weird texture, which texture is very important to me in foods. So yeah, that's something to. Something to consider. American foods, they're not always good for European metabolisms, but sometimes we can live with them. I can definitely live with tomatoes and potatoes, right?
But, yeah, count me in.
Right. People in the chat saying that Mrs. Jilvey is a condescending white girl. Yeah. Because, yeah, it is like the ultimate white person thing. I'm going to go to the ends of the earth and beat culture out of every population on the planet. I'm going to consume your foods. I'm going to appropriate your music and style of dress and think of myself as cultured.
Right? Tell me about it.
Right. The Aryan urge to just conquer everything in sight and
actually
not nailed down.
Now that that came up, you want to talk about it? You want to talk about Alex Graham's article? The what was it? Which Way White Liberal?
Oh, yes.
It's all about white women, apparently, yeah.
Speaking about white women, Alex Graham wrote Which Way White Liberal, which is a review of a book by, what's her name, Saira Rao and Regina Jackson, White Women, Everything You Already Know About Your Own Racism and How to Do Better. And it's a story of a black and Indian woman go around and have dinners with nice white ladies and basically harangue them and abuse them at these dinners. And the white ladies sign up for it. And that broke straight through my suspension of disbelief that someone would do it. But then I realized, yeah, we're talking about white liberal women here. Of course they would subject themselves to such masochistic pleasures. I don't know, Anthony. Have you met people who are like that, who would willingly invite these two disgusting non-white, anti-white women into their home to be harangued?
I mean, I can't think of anyone personally that I know in my life, but I've seen enough virtue signaling on social media to make me believe, yeah, there's probably a lot of people out there like that. Graham's article or his review, I wrote down a quote. He says, "This book is a gift to white nationalists," which I thought was funny because it, you know, it does seem to go over the top. Like you said, like it, you know, you don't even believe it initially. And it, his argument, Alex Graham's argument, is that it's, you know, it's going to force more white people, specifically white women, to identify as white and lean in that direction, which, you know, has a long-term macro effect, hopefully. But I was thinking about it because, like you said, it is hard to believe when you read this initially. First of all, I give him tons of credit. He said he read it in like a library and he had to refrain from laughing. So I guess it was like a humor piece to him, but I wouldn't have been able to make it through it. So more power to him. But when I thought about the believability aspect of this, and like you asked, like who actually would invite this into their home? I mean, look at 2020 with the summer of Floyd and the lengths people went through, you know, went through to virtue signal and show how anti-racist and what have you they were. I mean, it was, I mean, could you top that? I mean, this seems like small potatoes in comparison, you know? I mean, it's, so sadly, they're out there, you know?
It's amazing to me, and I agree with Mr. Graham when he says that making white women feel their race will probably backfire horribly on the liberals, on the non-whites. These people like Saira Rao and Regina Jackson, I think her name is, right? They're so used to being around white people who have been completely shorn of every sense of race. Mm-hmm. And white liberalism is, I guess, only really possible if you believe race. It's not a real thing, right? It's just something invented, something, or the liberals, the theory I think libtards are operating under right now is that essentially race is nothing but power relations. It doesn't mean anything, but because white people are evil, they made it mean something so that they can take power away from non-whites and transfer it to themselves, which is, it is what it is, I guess. It's internally consistent, at least. But I think that a lot of these low IQ, non-white, anti-white leftists, like Saira Rao, like Regina Jackson, they don't get it, right? They don't get it because they're driven primarily by resentment. And you can tell, and you can see it basically in their writing, and you can see it on Saira Rao's face, that she's driven primarily by resentment of white women because they are more beautiful than her. I think it really is as simple as that. I think a lot of anti-white hatred is really just them hating us because we are better looking, which, I mean, you mentioned the tall, strapping Scotch-Irish who would just barge into Indian country, and the squaws would just fawn over them, right? This is something that's been observed among the incel community, that it's disproportionately non-white, right? Incels, they tend to be Asian, then tend to be Indians. Many of them are black or mulatto. Many of them are mestizos, right? Mexicans or Arabs in some case over in Europe. And among them, there's an expression of just be white. You want to pick up girls, just be white, just be tall, just be pale skinned, just be good looking, you know, be intelligent, have a good sense of humor. And I think a lot of anti-whiteism from non-whites, not from white liberals, here including, of course, Jews, right? A lot of the anti-whitism from non-whites, including Jews, is based on they're prettier than us. Both the men are more handsome, the women are more beautiful. I really think it's as simple as that at the most basic level.
I'll say, I mean, I agree with you, but I'll put it even more broadly. And I think you just said it earlier, like it's a resentment thing, and not even on a looks level, but just on a civilizational level. You know, he was like a political commentator, I think as early as like the 70s and then into the 80s and 90s. Are you familiar with Joe Sobran?
Yeah, I'm familiar with Okay. Joe Sovereign, yeah.
Yeah. While you were mentioning that, I just pulled up a quick quote of his right here. I'll go through it real quick. He says, "Western man towers over the rest of the world in ways so large as to be almost inexpressible. It's Western exploration, science, and conquest that have revealed the world to itself. Other races feel like subjects of Western power long after colonialism, imperialism, and slavery have disappeared. The charge of racism puzzles whites who feel not hostility, but only baffled goodwill because they don't grasp what it really means. Humiliation. The white man presents an image of superiority even when he isn't conscious of it, and superiority excites envy. Destroying white civilization is the inmost desire of the League of Designated Victims we call minorities." And I mean, he says it right there. It's envy.
I've read that quote. And yeah. I used to agree with it until I observed very rich Jews and blacks and Arabs resenting very poor white people. So you think about it, you know, there's a lot of rich Jews in New York, right? There's a lot of rich Arabs all over the place. There's a lot of rich black athletes, and there's Oprah and all these people, and they all resent, right? The dirt poor Scotch Irish of Appalachia live rent free in these people's heads. And the Scotch Irish, we discussed them on the show, in the last show with Jim Goad, when we were discussing J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy. I mean, yeah, they tamed the frontier, but the civilization they built, it's not New York, right? It's not Hollywood.
Certainly not.
You know, Hollywood is something that the Jews built themselves. I really don't think it's a civilizational thing. I really don't think it's a civilizational achievement thing.
Okay, yeah, but even though the Scots-Irish didn't build Hollywood, they're still a part of the same broader people group or the same race as the people that did create all this science and history and beauty and everything like that. So, you know, like you said, like the rich Arab or the rich Jew living in some, you know, giant mansion, like his people didn't build the mansion. His people didn't build the government and the society in which the mansion resides, right? There's still, you know, essentially just guests here in that regard. So they resent all white people, poor or rich alike. At least in my opinion, that's what I took away when I read the Sovereign quote there. I had it saved on my computer.
I'm talking, of course, about my experience, because I've met quite a lot of rich and powerful non-whites. I never really got why they have such a chip on their shoulder about very poor, very, you know, sometimes, let's face facts, there are a lot of low IQ white people out there.
Tons.
These people resent them too.
They resent even
the uncivilized, the brutish white people. And fundamentally, I think it's a looks thing. I think it's really that petty, because only something that petty could excite hatred so intense, I guess. If it's a civilizational thing, I think that at some point they would have made peace with it and try to either assimilate to our own civilization or, I mean, help to their own, petty though it may be, because it's their own.
There's plenty of ugly white people too, though. Those low IQ Scots-Irish in the Appalachian Hills or whatever. That most of them ain't much to look at, but maybe that's their opioid addiction.
I wouldn't say so. I think that, yeah, I mean, there is a beauty to hill folk, which is maybe not classical, but there is something to be said about that.
No, I know what you mean, yeah.
Right, so I guess we're going to have to disagree there on the root of the resentment. But by far the more interesting thing that Mr. Graham points out, that Rao and Jackson may be awakening a sleeping giant, which is racial awareness among white liberal women. Now, I don't know if you think that's possible, but I've performed some experiments in that direction. Specifically, I've drawn the attention of some white liberal women I know to the fact that the bulk of animal abuse is, well, performed by non-whites. And of course, these are white women which love animals, and who doesn't love animals, really? Who wants to prevent animal cruelty? And I've had some interesting successes. Once you point it out, they'll accuse you of being racist, they'll deny it, but then they start noticing. And in a couple of months, they say, you know what? You're right. They really do abuse animals at a much higher rate. So
it's the same thing with the environment. A lot of liberal women are very passionate about the environment. And when you look at individuals or entire peoples that are doing the bulk of polluting, it's not us, right? The only reason I'm not as optimistic about them, turning the corner on these opinions or these views is because I've just seen it so many times, like you can be as gentle and broach the subject as cautious as you want, and they just shut down. They'll just block you out. They get the screech racist or whatever. And that works for them in their head. So I'm less optimistic, but I do see where the optimism stems from. I don't know how to change it though.
I mean, obviously you're going to have that reaction that this is just racism speaking. But if you manage to put the worm of doubt in their heads, because especially if they really care about pollution or animals or these things, right? If they really care about fairness, right? They're going to notice that non-whites are not fair. And, Sayra Rao and Regina Jackson are not fair. They're not fair to them, first and foremost, right?
Yeah.
If you point this out, I think the wheels are put in motion. I think the worm of doubt starts eating away at the egalitarianism, because race is a fact you cannot overlook. It's written on our faces, right? Mm-hmm. So we cannot really just unsee race. And once you start seeing it, you see it everywhere. You see that every significant difference on this planet is dictated by race and racial identity. So that's something to think about. I don't think that the reality of race can be put under the rug. I don't think there's a rug big enough to hide the reality of race.
I mean, we've been doing a pretty good job at it so far. Look how how far Western civ has fallen based on pretending race isn't real at this point already. It's. Have you seen those memes about something that racists and the liberal media have in common, and it's like making up names for black people, because the liberal media will never say a black man murdered a 2-year-old or raped a 9-year-old girl or something. It's always a stranger or a motorist or a problematic celebrator. They come up with increasingly bizarre names, and this is all in the name of pretending race isn't real. Like, we've gone this far with it. I don't know how much further it can go. Maybe we will turn a corner soon, and God, I hope so.
Yeah, I remember when Ahmad Arbery, what's his name, armed robbery, was shot in Georgia. They were calling him a jogger.
Yeah, exactly, right? A jogger,
and
yeah.
Yeah, for a while. I mean, do people still have the jogger gif? Put it in the D-Life chat. Always puts a smile on my face, that one, where he jogs with construction boots and a hammer.
Yeah.
It was really one of those amazing stuff. So I hear they call them joggers now. Hey, look at those joggers. And when they stole the 2020 American elections, they called them riggers.
Yeah.
Goddamn riggers.
I forgot about that one. That's funny.
Yeah.
Mostly peaceful protesters, pedestrians, motorists, problematic celebrators I saw after a riot. That one was funny.
Youths.
Youths. That's another popular.
They love youths in the United Kingdom, right? It's not blacks usually. It's Arabs and Pakistanis, but it's usually troubled youths.
Even though they're 26 years old and there's 40 of them, it'll be a gang of youths. Yeah. But again, they're doing that.
The plural of blacks is you got a flock of seagulls, a murder of crows, and a riot of blacks, huh?
Yeah, I guess so, right? But we see it, but does the average person see that? I have no idea anymore.
I don't think they can't see it. But again, the achievements in self-deception Crime Stop, right? Stop and Crime Think is really one of the greatest achievements of human and especially white psychology.
Oh yeah,
the ability the Chinese have an expression for it: point deer, make horse. Right? When the king wants you to see a horse, and it depends on your life to see a horse where there is in fact a deer, people get very good at pointing deer and making horse, even though, right? And I guess at some point, the reality of it, when you try to ride the thing, you know, you're gonna have to take it into account. But that's another thing. The Chinese, they're so cowed and docile, they're going to do that. But they've come out of the other end, the wrong end of the civilization cycle. Maybe that's our future. Maybe the future is where we can consciously deny reality the way the Chinese do, where power creates a reality of its own so strong that facts really do not matter anymore. That's probably...
I mean, you see it... You see it every day already.
Yeah.
I think that's why so many people come unglued now. You know, that's why you see these like spectacular protests unfolding in the streets and people just wigging out, going insane on camera. You know, though they can believe X, Y, or Z, whatever, the media tells them to, and whatever makes them seem the most anti-racist, like your subconscious still maintains awareness to falsehoods. So like deep down inside, though you've tricked yourself into believing a lie and making up a false reality, like your inner self knows it's not real. And that dichotomy can only go on for so long before you essentially just become unglued, and we're seeing it happen en masse right now. I don't know how much longer it can go on for.
I hope you're right, Anthony. I hope it's not just people like us who are deceiving themselves. I've been thinking about this for a while because we see the vast majority of people just ignoring truth and following power. And I'm thinking those of us who, when observing power distort truth, are compelled to speak truth to power repeatedly, even though we are beaten down repeatedly. I'm thinking, are they the stupid ones or are we the crazy ones?
And that's a good question.
Increasingly, I'm thinking that we are the crazy ones. We are nuts, unhinged. Who the hell dares tell the king that he's wearing no clothes?
Yeah.
We're nuts.
Yeah. There's sadly an element of truth to that.
Yeah. This is why I mean so many dysfunctional people are, I guess, are attracted to dissident politics, but it's something we have to acknowledge and deal with if we are going to be successful in what we're trying to achieve. And yes, because we are crazy people, you have to pay for our treatment. So you know where the Entropy link is, you know where the Cash App link is. I'm going to reload Entropy and see if we had donations. You know what? I have some spare lemons, so I'm going to break the ice and donate a couple. I'm feeling in a good. I'm in a good mood today. Right, that's nice. Let's see, yep, there it is. 14 lemons from me, from my own personal channel to the Countercurrents fundraiser. I guess we can buy our own hotel right now.
Nice.
But so since we are discussing people coming unglued, people becoming unhinged, I guess we have to address the Trump question, the bad idea whose time has come. An article by Greg Johnson. Very insightful, very interesting. Again, it's an America-centric show, I guess. And Anthony, tell me, in 2016, were you excited about Donald Trump?
I was. You know, whatever you want to call it, I guess I got red-pilled. In 2014 is when I first kind of, you know, came online and started discovering the world may not be as I knew it previously. So by the time Trump rolled around in 2016, I was really excited about this this political outsider coming and running and maybe shaking things up. And I did maintain my excitement for much of his presidency. That being said, I'm not overtly political in the sense that, like, I don't follow modern politics like day to day. But sadly, for better or worse, I do feel that Greg Johnson hit the nail on the head with his diagnosis of Trump then to Trump now and kind of what he represented and where he's going forward. It's in the title of the article, right? A Bad Idea Whose Time Has Come. Some of the reasons I liked him initially, and there's still positives I can say. You know, what he kind of served was, he kind of served, at least in my opinion, as a catalyst for pulling the curtain back, right? Like, I feel like he kind of revealed what was going on to a lot of normal people. Just recently, the black comedian Dave Chappelle, I'm sure you're aware of him, he was on Saturday Night Live, and he was kind of making jokes about this, and he brought up Trump, and he alluded to, you know, reasons people voted for him in droves. And, you know, this is like a mainstream, like, normal guy talking about it on like a popular comedy show. So, like, Trump served as a catalyst to getting a lot of this, a lot of things you're not supposed to speak about into the mainstream dialogue. Goods and bads. Greg mentions this in his article. He did accelerate the chaos. And though I too do not define myself as an accelerationist, without Trump winning the presidency in 2016, it just would have been a slow march toward the chaos that we're currently at right now, and demographic change throughout the West, and in particular the United States, would have kept going at pace. And Trump kind of just brought it all to the forefront in 2016, and it changed the game a lot. So he did serve a lot of good purposes, but sadly, he was a, you know, at least in my opinion, and it looked like Greg shares the same opinion in his article, was just a massively ineffective leader. It's kind of a shame. He couldn't resist the establishment, in my opinion. Who really can? The opposition is so leviathan and so all-powerful. I can't imagine anyone that can do that successfully. Trump did a terrible job. And in part, I think, because he is an egomaniac. It's not really about the country. It's sadly about him. And Greg talked about it. You know, he started out on the right issues. You know, immigration was one of the first things he mentioned out the gates. And I think that's what in part got him elected. And by the end of his presidency, when he was rerunning again in 2020, he just turned into a normie, you know, conservative ink guy pandering to, you know, name your minority or interest group. And sure enough, he did not get reelected.
Although, you know, the circumstances of that non-reelection, they're going to remain murky for the time being, until we can open the archives of the regime and see what actually happened there.
Yeah, in 100 years from now, right?
Yeah. Well, no, hope springs eternal. I will say, however, that the Trump campaign in 2016 was an integral part of my own red pilling. I was a libertarian previously, but then I really started thinking about, hold on, what if we could actually use state power to achieve the aims we're trying to achieve? And really, I think it got from there to where I am today. I became aware of my whiteness, of my racial identity. Libertarianism is another one of those things which are very white. And when you point this out to libertarians, they have one of two responses. The first is to accept it, which is very rare, right? And become race aware as a result of it. The second is to deny, screech, call you a racist, and disavow, disassociate, which is the far more common reaction. And
I imagine
sadly
so.
One that I've seen more often when I've interacted with people I used to call friends, you know, who were also libertarians. Now, the article was written before Kanye West announced his presidency. Have you been following that, Anthony?
No, I haven't. I heard it secondhand, which, you know, I kind of just laughed at. And I know he kind of like, I think he showed up at like Trump's home in Florida or something. The only take I've read on it so far was, most people in our spheres are familiar with Bronze Age Pervert, obviously. And on his like Telegram or something, I guess I'm not on Telegram, but I'd read it, like screenshot it or copy and paste it. He kind of wrote essentially like a tirade about this. And, I read it like two nights ago at like midnight. I was exhausted. So I didn't really fully grasp everything. I need to go back and reread it. But from what I gathered was he was kind of making the argument that Kanye deciding to run for president and trying to get tethered to Trump in some way or another is like an op, I guess, to further discredit and marginalize Trump, because Kanye is decidedly outside the club now at this point with what he's come out and said recently.
Well, you know, I think that's probably one of the worst takes I've ever heard. Kanye,
again, like I said, I don't follow this. It's just, what I read.
There is some speculation. It came from Keith Woods' Telegram that basically Bronze Age Pervert is panicking because these people are, I suspect they are in some way linked to Trump and his people and Chabad Lubavitch and all these Jewish groups, which is why they want to people to stay the hell away from the Jewish question. Don't ask these uncomfortable questions, right? And I think that the effect of Kanye West is he's going to completely cripple any attempt for Trump to go back to get back into serious politics. He's definitely aiming to split the radical right vote, split the MAGA vote, and maybe even get an edge over Trump on that. So the GOP primary, if it's Trump versus DeSantis versus Kanye West, it's going to be a shit show. And I think ultimately this is going to be good for white nationalism, the white nationalist cause. Not that I'm going to be supporting Kanye, but he is a wrecking ball which is hurtling towards both the Republican Party and the MAGA movement, which are two aspects of controlled opposition, mm-hmm. right? And I think that a serious Kanye run would destroy them utterly. And I am for that. I am for the utter destruction of the GOP and of the MAGA grift. I am for what MAGA stood for in 2016. I'm against what MAGA stood for in 2020. And this can be a good thing, right? Although, as people are saying in the chat, the important thing is not to take Kanye seriously. My take is and remains that he's having an extended chimp out. We're witnessing a chimp out. It is so much more. It's transparently about his ego. This guy's ego is wounded. He's having a black moment, right? Let's call it that. And it's extended and it's being fed by opportunistic people like Nick Fuentes and Milo Yiannopoulos. And they're going to do a lot of damage to the controlled opposition in the process. Of course, you know, I don't think Kanye is an accelerationist candidate. They're just going to disrupt the GOP and the MAGA grifts, which is always a good thing for us. Yes. As for what Bronze Age Pervert says, I mean, people should start ignoring that guy.
I read it two nights ago. I need to go back and reread it. But to your point, whatever helps accelerate the destruction of the GOP and we can finally get into some real issues, yeah, I'm all for that, man. I couldn't agree anymore. That's what honestly kind of worries me about Trump running again in 2024. In Greg's article, he mentions, you know, his campaign right now lacking the power and firebranding on immigration and other stuff that was so prevalent in 2016. this is my own take on it, but, you know, I feel like even if he did get elected, any real progress is just going to get delayed for another 4 years. It'll just be another clown show for four more years. Pro-white issues are going to get pushed to the right. Nothing's going to happen. And demographic change is going to continue to accelerate to a degree that makes it even harder to get anything done at the end of another 4 year shit show. I don't think he's going to get reelected, but I have no idea at this point.
I wouldn't know. I think it's up in the air. I see a lot of fanaticism and blind faith among the MAGA crowd, which I don't think we should underestimate. Like, we spoke about people's ability to censor reality out, to edit reality out. Mm-hmm. And we witnessed the Q phenomenon. And indeed, it was, of course, a psyop. It was orchestrated by the Pentagon, by Trump's people in the Pentagon, all these revolting Jews in military intelligence, like Ezra Cohen Watnick and what's his name? I forget. But the material for it is there. I think that white people, right-wing white people, Christian white people in America, you have the Christian nationalism thing, they're so desperate for hope that something is some way of going back to normality, of this blessed time where they didn't have to think about race and survival, that they're willing to grasp to any straw, including MAGA, and they're willing to edit out all uncomfortable realities that Trump basically jettisoned the anti-immigration populist agenda the second he was sworn in. They're editing out these very uncomfortable facts that he is an Israel firster, that he's not America first, that he's a dangerous egomaniac who's really driving American populism into the ground with his behavior, not allowing it to grow beyond him. Because only if it becomes a very broad movement and uniting a lot of people instead of a personality cult can American nationalism and American populism win.
Yeah, but we don't have that. We have the latter. We have the personality movement, like you just said.
We have a personality cult. I wasn't sure whether it's a personality cult or not until, I guess, in late 2019, when I first saw people on Twitter, like MAGA people on Twitter, basically describing Trump's sexual exploits. And it made me realize that, and I have an article on this. I forget the name. Jesus Christ, I forget the name. It reminded me of Yugo boomers, like Yugoslav boomers, basically describing Josip Broz Tito's sexual exploits as if they're own.
Yeah.
If you haven't had a Yugo boomer explain to you in excruciating detail how Comrade Tito fucked Sophia Loren, you really don't know. You know, it's like you're thinking about it. When I boast about my sexual conquest, I get that face, you know, with the glinting eyes and this heaving chest. But
yeah.
It's like when you're describing, yeah, dear leader, you know what sort of a woman she was back in the day. Well, he fucked her. Yeah. It's like, Jesus fucking Christ, man.
Yeah, calm
you
down.
You weren't
right?
There.
Yeah.
You weren't there. But then you realize it's a personality cult. They're living vicariously through the cult figure. They're fucking Sophia Loren vicariously through the cult leader. I'm sorry, this is a family show.
But, you know what, though? I got to say.
That's where I realized this is a personality cult. They're not going to listen to argumentation about what he did or didn't do in office. No, they worship this guy.
Yeah, I feel bad. I was just going to say, I feel bad for, you know, a lot of his diehard followers. Because at least when he ran in 2016, like, Trump did not directly appeal to white people or white interests, but he did, you know, tip his cap to historically marginalized groups in this country, which is just, for example, like our entire Rust Belt and name your flyover state in this country. These people have been ignored by their own government, you know, since the Kennedy era, and their industry and family and institutions and everything have just been uprooted and deracinated. And these are miserable places and miserable people now. And like, ironically, this New York billionaire shows up on the scene and essentially points directly at them. And he's like, you've gotten a raw deal and I'm your guy. So like, of course they're going to be like devout, you know, pathological followers to this guy, because all he had to do was wink at them. And you know, look what happened in his presidency. Like, he did try initially, but he didn't really get anything done for these people, but he still made an overt to them. And, you know, that's, I guess that's where we're at with his followers. You know, they're in it for the long run. And you can't help but feel.
That's like that guy who's never really had any female interactions. So the first time, you know, a woman is anything but completely dismissive of him, he thinks she's in love with him.
Exactly. Exactly. That's a great way to put it.
It is sad. It is what it is. But as Greg says, it's a bad idea whose time has come. Maybe. I don't know. We'll see. I think that this spoiling attack from Kanye is going to make a lot of difference. I could be wrong. It could be just wishful thinking on my part, because I really want the MAGA grip to be over. I think that the level of deception and manipulation and just pure grift, like pure transfer of value, monetary value from the poorest Americans to this literal billionaire is just disgusting.
It is. Somebody wrote about it on Countercurrents like a year ago. I think the article was like literally titled "Avoid the MAGA Grift."
That was me.
Oh, was it you? Oh, okay. Well, there you go. I remember reading it like a year ago. I can't remember your specific talking points, but like, it hits the nail on the head, man. Like,
I saw some of these messages and emails which Trump sent to people, and they were like, "You're a traitor. You abandoned Trump. Donate $18 in the next 10 minutes, or I will assume you have joined the socialists." And I just saw that, and I'm like, this is disgusting.
Yeah, you're like, calm down, you know?
This should be actionable. People should hang for this. It really riled me up.
No, it's a bummer.
It is. Yeah, it's the essay is called "Ignore the MAGA Grift, Join the Gentleman's Salon." It's a fundraiser.
There you go. Yeah. Well, I remember reading it. It was good.
Yeah, thanks for that. So yeah, I'm sick to the back teeth of Donald J. Trump. The J stands for Jew, in case you're wondering. And I hope Kanye just comes in like a wrecking ball and destroys anything that's really left of the MAGA grift.
Yeah.
And so speaking of electoral politics, you got anything to add, Anthony?
No.
Well, that's good. Speaking of electoral politics, you had elections in America recently, right?
Yes, we did.
Yeah. And there were a lot of essays on the elections in America on Countercurrents, but I chose one which I think was overlooked, right? By Morris Van de Kamp, "The Red Ripple Was a Triumph for White Advocates." Now, there is a string of optimism there from Morris Van de Kamp. He says that the American election result, the midterm election results, are actually good for white advocates, for white nationalists, for white identitarians. If you would care to, you know, explain it briefly.
Yeah. So like I did say with the article on Trump, like I do not follow current politics too closely. So like, obviously I'm not totally clueless. You know, I know there's midterm elections. I know the red wave turns into a, you know, a red fart or a red ripple, like Morris Van de Kamp said. So, I mean, his article was just as much educational for me as it was any other one. I also read two other ones on Countercurrents, Kevin McDonald's, which was obviously a little more pessimistic. And I can't remember the third one that I read. Maybe it was elsewhere. But yeah, Morris's, it was good. I liked it a lot. I do applaud his optimism, specifically for people interested in white identity politics. since I'm not that up to date on current politics, I'll defer my optimism to him. Maybe I'm, you know, too black-pilling all the time, but there's so much bad stuff going on right now. Crime and the economy, the war going on in Europe, still massive immigration issues all throughout the West, especially in America. I guess I'm just weary of ever reading the tea leaves and trying to spin something, getting all 4D chess and, oh, this is really good for us because of, you know, these mental gymnastics. I don't think Morris did that by any means. I'm just wary of ever doing it myself. And I did like the way he kind of summed it up at the end, though, with his optimism. So some of his examples were some people that some politicians actually won that were campaigning with like race focused strategies. So that is a major surprise. There was a few other things he mentioned in there. He cited some of the potential, you know, less than enthusiastic support to Roe v. Wade turning over recently. And I think he makes a good point with that as well. So, I mean, yeah, the article, by no means his optimism wasn't out to lunch or anything, but like I said, I'll defer to him on it.
Indeed. It's personally, I mean, I look at the American elections and I noticed that the Republicans were trying to run on a platform of not the other guy, right? That was the platform. We're not the other guy. And that's something that's been worrying me, that basically both left and right wing of our enemy will be able to run against each other on just platforms of not the other guy and not offer anything concrete to the electorate, not offer anything concrete to the people. And we would be in political stasis for a very long time instead of moving forward, instead of accelerating towards whatever it is we're accelerating against. But I find it refreshing that the Republicans ran on "we're not the other guy," and they didn't lose, but they didn't really win either.
Yeah.
So I see that as a cause for optimism. I think that the most controversial part of Morris's article is, though, that he says that the victory of John Fetterman in Pennsylvania is a good thing. And I got to admit, I shared this meme on my Telegram page as well, and I loved it. It's one of the funniest memes I've seen all year. It's Americans would rather vote for a retarded person than a Turk, making me prouder than I'm like, yeah, this is actually, yeah, this is making sense. And Morris quotes Peter Brimelow, and Brimelow says that basically Mehmet Oz, right, he's named Mehmet Genghis also. He's named after Muhammad and Genghis Khan. He's a Turkish citizen as well as American, served in the Turkish army, although I guess he grew up in America from a very young age. But still, it is a victory for the white man won. Now, he's a Democrat, and he's got, you know, the thing with his brain.
Yeah. He's a fucking
but,
idiot.
You know, a
yeah.
white retard can beat a genius Turkish doctor. What can I say?
That, yeah, I remember reading that in his article, and I couldn't help but chuckle. You know, I just laughed at, you know, the way it's juxtaposed there. I don't have anything to say on it, man. I'm not even familiar with Fetterman's viewpoints. Does he even have any? I just know he's a moron, and that's literally about it. I have no idea what's going to come of it.
It is. Yeah, people are pointing out in the chat that Greg Johnson wrote out his proper name translated and decodified as Muhammad Genghis Oz, and it's not even Oz; it's Iz. Right, because it's got the two dots over the O. So you open your mouth to say O, but you say I.
There you go again, pronouncing everything correctly. So
Mehmet Genghis is, right? That's his full name, not Dr. Oz. He's not a wizard.
I'm going to keep calling him Oz anyways.
Right, it's very difficult for English speakers to pronounce these names. Right. I'm not sure what it means in Turkish, to be honest. I used to know. I used to understand Turkish a lot better. Not anymore. But I get that's a very controversial take. Fetterman is a Democrat, and I've heard it somewhere that basically nominating him was a sort of humiliation ritual imposed on the Pennsylvania public that the election was rigged. But you were going to have those claims anyways if the election was rigged. Nowadays, you're not really sure if elections are even real or not. Something I spoke to about with Jason Kessler, he had me on election night on his show, which is also on DLive and on Telegram. So, you know, if our moderators would just link to that if they could. And I just mentioned, does voting even make sense in if they can just steal the election, just rig every election the way they wanted to? What do you think, Anthony? Do you think voting really even makes sense in any way, campaigning to convince people to vote or not vote? If they can just manufacture electoral victories, right, the enemy, is there any point to bothering it?
I'm really glad that you asked this. I'll tell you right off the bat, I don't have a solid answer for you, but I think I have the same thought quite a bit. You know, I jump back and forth in my head all the time. On the one side, it's like, you know, go vote and do your civic duty and be a part of this. And then the other side of me can't help but think, like, this is all kabuki theater, right? This is one giant fucking spectacle. It's a big show. It's going to go its own way with my participation or not, and it doesn't matter. I'll defer to the master pronunciation guy here, yourself, on how to say his name. Who's the French guy that wrote Simulacra and Simulation? Baudrillard, is that how you say it?
Baudrillard.
Baudrillard. I can say that 10 times, and I'm never going to get it right. No, so, yeah, that guy.
Baudrillard. It's, when you break it down into bits, it's not that hard.
All right, well, I'm going to call him by his first name then. But you know you were primarily educated online when you can't pronounce anything right, right? But anyways, I was reading Simulacra and Simulation not that long ago. I just have it right here. I was going through a quote. He says, it's not by chance that advertising, after having for a long time carried an implicit ultimatum of an economic kind, fundamentally saying and repeating incessantly, I buy, I consume, and I take pleasure. Today it repeats in other forms, I vote, I participate, I am present, I am concerned. And it's funny how, you know, I feel like he kind of hit the nail on the head, how advertising has jumped from just like purely consumer centric to like buy shit to, and he wrote this in like the 80s, I think, to like, now you have to show how concerned you are, and how you vote and you participate. And when I read that, it kind of made me feel like it might not matter to a degree. Like, is this all just one advertising campaign to, you know, make me participate in the spectacle and in the theater and you know, and think I'm helping? I don't know. I know that sounds pessimistic and I'm probably reading too much into it. You know, I'm sure voting does matter to a degree, but I mean, not really, right? Like, even let's say voting really does matter and it does count. If you're a super conservative guy in New York or California, like, guess what? It doesn't fucking matter because they're going to vote the same way every time regardless. So I really don't have an answer, but
they don't even need voter fraud or election fraud to subvert your will. All they really have to do is make sure there is never a candidate who represents your views. This is why Trump was so dangerous in 2016. He snuck past the gatekeepers,
mm-hmm.
but then he turned out to be so easily corruptible, right, that it didn't matter in the end.
Yeah,
but really, I think that the actual subversion of the will of the people does not happen in the sense that they are forging, you know, ballots or whatever. I think it happens at the selection process for candidates, the primaries, the question of who is going to be put in front of you on the television screens and on social media, which the enemy controls, right? You're going to think about people running for office, right? They're going to be put in front of you. You'll be literally presented with these things by means of political propaganda, which is similar to economic profit, as Baudrillard points out, it's at that level that the control is exercised. Trump was just someone who already had a media presence, and I guess for reasons more related to narcissism than ideology, decided to break the rules.
Yeah, he was an interloper. Yeah.
And eventually he got handled. They didn't even need voter fraud to handle him. They co-opted him.
Oh, and big time.
On January 20th, 2017, Trump was already co-opted, I believe. And that was, people in the chat are saying, vote, this isn't the land of Oz. No, it's not. Pennsylvania is not the land of Oz.
No, certainly not. Only the land, what you say is, right?
It is. Jim Goad in the chat, he's been in the chat all evening, says, voting is anti-riot insurance and not much else. It gives people the illusion that their opinion matters. I'm tempted to agree.
I agree as well. Again, unfortunately, I wish it packed more of a punch, but the proof is in the pudding, right? You know, has it done much? Has voting really done much lately? It doesn't seem so. Burning down buildings and rioting in the street has seemed to accomplish a lot more lately, unfortunately.
Not that we advocate for burning down buildings and
of course
rioting
not.
In the streets. You know, we are advocating for mostly peaceful protesting.
Yeah, mostly peaceful. That's right.
Mostly peaceful. Yeah. So that's our guess, our position on voting and elections. It's very uplifting. What can I say? I don't think we're going to vote our way out of this predicament we're in as a race.
I don't think so either.
We have to first construct a very strong metapolitical framework on which to start building. And then, only then do we make political moves. But until then, our job is metapolitics. Our job is education. It's activism. It's creation of culture, creation of institutions, stuff like that. And it's not glamorous until you win. When you win, everything is glamorous, you know.
I think it is glamorous. That's the stuff I'm interested in. Creation of culture, the refining of it and stuff. Like that's what interests me as a person. Like reading boring legislation that isn't going to do anything in it, like or just listening to some guy lie to me during a campaign who's going to do the exact opposite. Like that's not fun to me, you know. The stuff that we do here actually does, it is fun in a way.
Although I will say that, drafting policies needn't be boring, right?
That's true.
Because they tell you that, oh, all of the important questions are settled, now we're just going to discuss, you know, the shades of the drapes. I think this makes politics boring for people. If you get into genuine politics, like fighting the enemies of your tribe, which is politics in the Schmittian sense, I think they're anything but boring. I think if you start thinking about what is our racist future, how we can unite the various nations, white nations of the world, without erasing their specificities. How can we solve this? And you approach it as a mathematical problem to be solved. How can we coexist with whites? If we cannot, what is the manner of dialectic we should undertake with their nations, right? Then politics becomes very interesting. And
politics, that's true.
Yeah, it becomes very, so I think they're trying to condition us into thinking, yeah, this is boring stuff, so we don't think about it. We don't think about it in that direction. So yeah, that is my position on it. Let's move on, right? In the spirit of metapolitics, let's move on to something more uplifting. Now I gotta ask you, Anthony, are you sitting comfortably?
I am right now, yeah. I'm in my little home office. It's very comfortable.
Well, I regret to inform you that you are homo confort. And I'm talking, of course, about Michael Walker's review of homo confort, which apparently means man in comfort. A book by, let me just get this name right, Stefano Boni, an Italian author about the dangers of a society built around comfort, right? And our society is, of course, built around the pursuit of comfort, security, and hygiene.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting review, very interesting book, thought-provoking, even though I wouldn't say fully agree with the findings over there. But let's hear your take first, Anthony.
Yeah, like you and I were talking about it earlier before we went online. I haven't read the book, and I didn't get through all of Michael Walker's review. I kind of just ran out of time, but what I did read of it was super interesting. He seems like he really broke the book down really well. His review, as well as the book itself, do seem fascinating. I would like to read it if I have time in the future. I like the coined term that the book's author uses. Walker says he uses it throughout hyper technology, and he kind of refers to it as a dictatorship of technology. How technological progress becomes authoritarian, essentially. I do think the proof is in the pudding. If you look around, this does seem to be the way that we're shifting. And in a general, in the most broad sense, his review kind of talks about a shift away from the natural state of things, from nature, and towards this hyper technology. I thought about some differences in here. The city versus the country dichotomy. Walker, in his review, talks about the book's mentions of progress, how all progress is, supposed to be good, but clearly progress in and of itself is not good. I forget Walker's specific example he uses in his review, but, he says like, your cancerous tumor has progressed. It's grown bigger. That's obviously not a good version of progress, right? So progress for the sake of progress is not a good thing. And he kind of talks about how technological advancement needs to be useful, which I did find interesting. I'm not particularly sure. Again, I kind of skimmed the review. If Walker gets into it in the review, or if Boney gets into it in his book itself. But the one thing I was mulling over after I read this was that all this technological progress that we're told is the most wonderful thing. And this is a guy, I guess why I do broadly agree with the thesis on the book is it never works as advertised, right? When the highway system was first implemented in America and then throughout the West, nobody forecasts perpetual gridlock and mile-long traffic jams. How many times have you gone to use an electronic device and the battery drained? The power grid, lights our streets and everything is tied into it. And every time the power goes out, you're essentially hamstrung. You can't do anything without it so suddenly. And that's Boney's points about technology being a bit of a dictatorship. So he kind of paints it as a dystopia in a way. And I do have sympathies toward that perspective. That being said, here are you and I talking across the globe right now, real time with technology, and it's fucking awesome. So it is a bit of a double-edged sword.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this because when you mention it, that you're basically dependent on technology. So let's say that power went out in my house and the central heating went out. I would freeze to death right now. And I wouldn't be able to heat it. It's an apartment, right? I wouldn't be able to heat it the traditional way, even if I did have wood, right? Because I don't have a chimney.
No, yeah, it's not even an option.
So it's not an option for me. So if both the power and the central heating go out, and right now the central heating is out, and I have a backup, electrical radiator for just such an emergency, I'm fucked.
Yeah,
I'm fucked.
That's terrifying.
It's not even the dead of winter. It's still just November. And you think about it, I don't even have the option of, obtaining wood. I know how to get wood. I know how to split wood with an axe. I have an axe. But well, I cannot even use that to heat my house because I don't have a chimney, I don't have a fireplace. It was just not thought of when this building was built because, hey, it was it's a new, brand new era. We have central heating, we have electricity. You know, it's one of those things, I guess. We do not plan for this. And we're going to see how people are going to cope with it in Ukraine right now because the power grid has been completely destroyed by the Russians.
Yeah.
And the way that Ukrainians are going to survive, they're going to adapt from living in the modern world to basically a world without comfort, it's going to be very instructional. Of course, we're not going to learn about it during the war. We're only really going to have realistic reports of that after the war ends, of how things really went down. I suspect it's going to be tough. But since we're talking about that, I mean, that's a excellent counterpoint, which Walker makes at the end of the review. I don't know if you got that far, that basically, what comforts do we keep? What comforts do we throw out? Do we throw out central heating and keep electricity? Do we throw out electricity and keep central heating? Or maybe, you know, immediate communications, we get rid of that. We go back to rotary telephones, which I wouldn't oppose horribly. No. I've always felt that the cell phone is a kind of a leash, right? You can always absolutely. Be reached. The beauty of roaming the streets, you know, back in the 90s and early 2000s when I didn't have a cell phone was that, well, no, they couldn't reach me even if they wanted to. I was free even though I wasn't, you know, six.
Yeah. I even thought about it the way it's projected in film. So when you watch a movie, you know, from before the age of cell phone technology and someone picks up a landline in their house or, you know, goes to a payphone and drops a quarter in, you don't necessarily wince or anything. It just looks totally normal. But like when you see an actor like playing with an iPhone in like Name Your Hit Movie, like there's something about it that just feels like synthetic and like cheesy and a little too like now-ish. Maybe I'm just getting nostalgic here, but like there is something about it. Like, you know, you can watch Brad Pitt play with a cell phone on a movie and you're still just like, oh, he just looks like a millennial turd, you know? Yeah. Like you said, it's a leash in a lot of ways and it makes people seem and look leashed.
Yeah, but on the other hand, like we're saying, a lot of Ukrainians right now are facing life without electricity, without central heating, without reliable water supply, because that relies on electricity too.
Yep.
Do we want to be those guys?
No.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure I want to be those guys. I'm not sure I want to live without central heating and electricity. Because the good thing about central heating is you don't think about it in the morning. Right, because if you're using wood to hit yourself, you know, you got to heat up your house. It's a chore in the morning.
Yeah,
and you have less leisure time for everything else you need to do. And if you're like me, you're a white identitarian activist and content creator. You need a lot of leisure time to get things going cause wise.
Absolutely.
People who are political have a lot of leisure time. It's something that really sunk into my mind from last show with Jim Goad, that the most people in the creative professions are not necessarily the most creative, but it's the people who have the space to be creative, right? People
yeah.
who don't really think about money, who have a lot of leisure. And I guess here I'm going to quote Oscar Wilde from his essay, The Soul of Man Under Socialism. The gist of it is essentially when you externalize labor to machines, you're going to get a creative society because people are going to be freer to be creative. Now, the reality of it is most people wouldn't know what to do with their freedom. But people like Oscar Wilde, who were not born rich, and we forget Oscar Wilde was actually born rich,
mm-hmm.
they're going to be free to practice what they want to practice. They're creative. To realize their full creative potential. And that, I guess, is one positive aspect of the age of comfort when you're not continually distracted with the ugly business of survival. You get to devote yourself to beauty.
Though that's true, Completely. And you and I are, you know, I think of the same ilk in that way. Like we take our leisure time and pursue leisurely things with it, right? Like I'm not trying to set ourselves aside and, you know, say we're some higher being, but like that type of person is the extreme minority. Like I know I have family members that would rather chew glass than open a single page of a book, right? Like, I have family members that are going to work themselves to death because all they know how to do is work. They simply can't pick up a hobby, anything beyond watching like trash TV or something like that. And you know, when you read, you know, this turn of the century, well, turn of the last century, like socialist utopia manifestos, and you know, everyone was a socialist back then, even the architects, right? They were all talking about like, oh, this building's going to help give everyone time for leisure because everything's going to be automated and blah, blah, blah. Like what they don't realize is like, not everyone's going to go to the state funded opera house. You know, like the average working man is just going to say, that's fucking gay. And then like, you know, just try to work more because that's all he knows how to do. Like there's a very thin sliver of society that actually uses their leisure time more appropriately. And I'm not saying that means we need to necessitate like the constant, you know, working just to survive, right? Like you said, for example, heat, like not having to heat your house in the morning is a chore I'm fine not doing. But there's a lot of one track mind people that will be given that task and not think twice about it. I was joking with a family member recently talking about like, actually before I even read this review, we're talking about modern creature comforts. And, you know, I said something, we're talking about ancient Egypt, and I said something along the lines of like, thank God I exist today. You know, I wouldn't have made it, you know, as a laborer building one of like the great pyramids or something like that. And he said, oh, you know, you're smart. You would have been a scribe. And then I said, yeah, or a fucking eunuch in the queen's chambers, right? You know, like it's an absolute miserable place, and time to be alive probably. And like only the strongest survived. The fact I don't have to go out and fend off like roving bands of savages and chop down a forest to heat up my own house means I get to do all this kind of stuff. But
that's another aspect of it. Since we have central heating and heat our homes mostly with coal and gas, we are seeing a resurgence of forests, especially in Europe.
Yeah.
Previously, we had deforestation both for heating and for agriculture, but because now we use land more efficiently and heat our homes more efficiently, mostly through central means, because central heating, because of just the vast scale of it, has economies of scale. You can use less material to heat more homes.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're basically burning less fuel. We're using more efficient fuels, like gas and coal and oil instead of wood. We're not deforesting Europe anymore. And
that is a good, that's good progress. Thing. Yeah.
I like forests for their own sake. I gotta be honest.
You and me both.
The German in me loves forests for their own sake. What can I say?
Yeah. To Walker's point, like that's progress, right? And that's a good kind of progress, right? Like there's a good use to that technological progress. Like, oh, we don't have to chop down entire forests to heat up our homes now. We can use something else, and we'll continue to progress in the right direction with that, hopefully. But yeah, not all progress is necessarily good. I was thinking about just recently, you know, a lot of people have, you know, really complicated ways to enter their homes now. There's smart locks, and you got to use your phone hooked up to wireless to, you know, swipe it across the smart lock to unlatch it, and you know, all these technology infused ways to enter your home. It's like, wait a minute. Like, do you really need fucking batteries to cross through a doorway into your home? Like, that's ridiculous. Like, that's totally superfluous. You don't need that.
That's insane.
It is. Yeah. Like, what if
there's a power outage?
Exactly. And there's mechanical lock backups and stuff like that.
I live in an area which is notorious for having earthquakes. So let's say I'm locked in my house because I lock my door, front door. There's an earthquake and the power automatically cuts out to prevent fires. So I'm trapped in my house during an earthquake or during a fire.
Yeah, that doesn't sound good. Now, I know these companies out here, Latch, they have mechanical backups and stuff, but like the idea that you still need a satellite floating through space to get through your front door, you're like, dude, calm down. You know, like,
What if a meteor strikes the satellite?
This is like a level of dependency.
You don't really think about these things until they happen to you. But yeah, there's going to be an earthquake where I live. It's going to be serious. I'm going to probably need to run away from this place very fast. I don't want to depend on electricity for that.
No, exactly. Like that's a really basic function. You shouldn't need batteries for it, right?
Right. Yeah. So I guess but that doesn't really fall under comfort. I think it would be very. I just find more comfort in unlocking the door by using the old fashioned way. It feels good to have keys in your hand.
Yeah, it's real, right? It's like a thing.
So, I mean, that's a very thought-provoking book, and I think that Michael Walker gives us both sides of the issues actually fairly well. And but there's definitely something to be said for comfort. The extreme discomfort suffered by our ancestors really did impede them in many ways, I would say. But I guess it also gave their lives a meaning, the overcoming of difficulty. Though as white identitarians and nationalists, I do not think we want for difficulty in our elected lives.
No, that one I'll take the easier route on that one, please.
We have, of course, one super chat from Reed Johnson over on Odyssey for $5 American, and he says, I'd like to thank Anthony Bavaria for being our guest and handling this monthly variety program. I encourage everyone to check out his latest article, Jeff Costello's Heidegger in Chicago, and his archive of material at Countercurrents. And remember, this holiday season, a Countercurrents paywall subscription makes a great gift. Well, thank you for your kind words, Reed.
Yeah, and that book was great. So I'd recommend everyone pick it up. It was an easy read, and it was funny as shit. And you don't need to be a scholar on Heidegger to get it. So I'm certainly not, and I was able to make my way through it. So definitely check it out.
I love that bit where Heidegger and Husserl, Heidegger sells to Husserl, right? We got a full tank of gas, a half pack of cigarettes. We're on a mission from God. It's dark and we're wearing sunglasses. And then Husserl says, hit it.
Yeah. Ready to go.
Right. So, Anthony, we've been gabbing away for almost 2 hours. So if you have any concluding thoughts for today, you think that we had a general theme of talking about things. I mean, we talked a lot about America. We talked a lot about situation in America, Trump, Kanye West, midterm elections, Thanksgiving. What do you think? Is there anything that ties it all together?
I don't know. I guess it's Countercurrents, right? So white identity politics.
I guess there's so much of it in the air where you don't really think about it. But sometimes I wake up in the morning and I think to myself, holy shit, you're a white nationalist.
Yeah.
Would you have believed this if someone told you 10 years ago? And I'm like, yeah, I would have.
Yeah, probably, right?
So thank you for being our guest tonight, Anthony. It was really a wonderful experience.
Yeah, again, thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah. And I guess this has been the Writer's Block. I'm your friend and host, Nicholas R. Gilvey. Our guest tonight was Anthony Bavaria, a writer for Countercurrents. Go check out his work once the show is done. I want to thank everyone who donated tonight, including myself, especially myself. Your donations is what keeps this operation running, what keeps Countercurrents running. I want to thank everyone who tuned in live and everyone catching the replay. We do this song and dance for you, to edify you, so that you become better activists for our cause, better white nationalists. We're building better identitarians. That is my goal in life. I want to thank everyone who commented over in the DLive and Odyssey chats. I rely on the chat a lot to create the content, to direct this show. You people are doing me a major service. And finally, I want to thank our courageous and indomitable moderators, Yadius Maximus, Reed Johnson, and Bartleby, for keeping chat safe and keeping everyone abreast of the latest developments in links to be read, just adding to your reading list all the time. And with that, folks, I guess that's it. Bye-bye. Take care.